I'm Theo Greenlee, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media and KUCB, where I work in on Alaska, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Haines, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news, Alaska News Nightly, or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
For decades, most Americans have relied on the American Medical Association, the AMA, the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, and their own local physician to get advice and guidance on everything from a healthy diet and exercise to air quality, disease prevention, and which annual vaccines they should get. But the Trump administration's pick of RFK Jr. as Health and Human Services Secretary has cast confusion and doubt on longstanding medical norms. What do two of Alaska's top doctors think of his ideas, and how might it affect public health in the future? We'll find out when they join us for today's Talk of Alaska.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello from Alaska Public Media. It's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. Vaccines are the foundation of public health. They're safe, effective, and have led to nearly eradicating many terrible illnesses. Now the country's top public health official is a vaccine skeptic. Mr. Kennedy Jr. is not a medical professional. He's an attorney. Where is he creating concern when denouncing adherence to longstanding public health policy? What do you need to know to make good decisions for your family? We've got two doctors with extensive public health experience in our state to answer these questions and more today as Dr. Jay Butler and Dr. Ann Zink join us. Dr. Butler most recently was the Deputy Director for Infectious Disease at the CDC. Dr. Butler is also the former Chief Medical Officer for Alaska and held a number of positions before that. He will be starting a new position in December as the Dean of the College of Health at UAA. We'll hear more about that soon. And Dr. Ann Zink is also a former Chief Medical Officer for Alaska. Dr. Zink works as an emergency room physician in Palmer. She is the president of the Association of State and Territorial Health Officers. And both doctors with us today are hosts of Line 1, Your Health Connection. Welcome, both of you. Dr. Butler, so good to have you in the studio with me. It's been quite a long time. And Dr. Zink, wish you could be here in person, but we're glad you're on the line with us.
Thank you, Lori. It's great to be here. That introduction makes me think, here's a guy who can't hold down a job, apparently, but it's good to be back on Talk of Alaska.
Well, we're certainly glad to have you. Dr. Zink, you as well. I'm in high company here today. So, Dr. Butler, before we discuss public health concerns, tell us about your news. You'll be taking on a new role at UAA in December. Tell us about this new position for yourself.
Yes, I'm looking forward to stepping into the role of Dean of the College of Health at University of Alaska Anchorage. It is a very broad portfolio that the college carries, all the way from doctorate level degrees for advanced practice nurses, the WAMI medical program for doctorate in medicine, number of master's programs, certificate programs as well, such as nursing assistant. The criminal justice program is also in the College of Health. So the Alaska Justice Center, as well as the pre-law programs, are also in the College of Health. So one of the things I really love about that approach is it takes a very broad approach to what is health. It's not just health care, but what are the societal drivers that determine whether or not we live healthy or not.
And so is the law part of this related to better understanding public health policy or?
No, it's much broader than that. It really is. If you were going to another university in a pre-law program, it may not be in the College of Health, but it's where it landed when the College of Health was created out of the College of Arts and Sciences back, probably about 13, 14 years ago.
All right. So, Dr. Butler, Dr. Zink, before we turn to you, I want to get a little more time here with Dr. Butler. You left the CDC in late May, but turned in resignation paperwork in February. What happened? Why then?
Well, I could sort of see the writing on the wall. Have had some contact with Mr. Kennedy in the past and had an idea what his views were. I don't think it was so much the views that bothered me so much as the methodology, that it really wasn't based on science and what the evidence is. So my approach was to plan a glide path to leave. I did not take the fork in the road. I did not take early retirement. I was eligible for a regular retirement, so I put in the paperwork to leave at the end of May, which also provided time to tuck in a lot of the work that I was doing that was related to H5N1 avian influenza. Never really looked back after I had that paperwork in. The other advantage of having a long glide path is I could abort my landing if I needed to, but never really did that. With some of the changes and the policies that were coming down, it was very hard to do other aspects of my job, which a lot of which was focused on global health security. And if you can't talk with the leaders of public health agencies, ministries of health in other countries, you can't travel. That's really hard to get that kind of work done.
All right. So for both of you, the government shutdown is dragging on partially, well, it seems like primarily because of healthcare expense. What do you think could work for the United States? Have you thought about what type of health system would make sense for our country? Is it the Canadian-style healthcare system? Is it expanded Medicare for all? What makes sense? Or are you loath to weigh in on something like that? So gauging the look on Dr. Butler's face. Dr. Zink, do you want to start here?
Yeah, no, I'm happy to. I appreciate Lori for having me on the call. I always appreciate Dr. Butler's perspective. I am no longer the Association State and Territorial Health President. I stepped down from that when I stepped down my role as a state. But one of the things I really loved about working at the state of Alaska was the mission of the Department of Health, which was the health, well-being, and self-sufficiency of every Alaskan. And when I think about what sort of health system that we need in our country, we want, I think a lot about that. What makes us healthy? What makes us well? And what gives us choice to be able to move those directions? We do know that 80% of our health is determined by things outside of healthcare. So just as Dr. Butler was talking about this large percentage of things he'll be overseeing in the College of Health and excited for him in that role, we see that in the MAHA movement right now and talking about dyes and food. And I think there's actually a lot of similarity between a lot of public health work for a long time, as well as what we're seeing now. It's just a matter of implementation in some of the ways that they come forward. But I think about the way that we can build on that vision of making sure that healthcare is safe, making sure that we have choice, making sure that things that impact all of us, you know, we have speed limits on the road. And so what ways can we have common understanding for things like infectious disease and vaccines in schools to make sure kids can be there. At the end of the day, the health policy that I want as a mom is really different than the health policy I want as a policymaker. And I think we need to acknowledge that. As a health policymaker, I want the best care for the cheapest price for the most people. But what I want as a mom is absolutely everything. Get out of my way. I'm going to do anything and everything possible for my child. And so I think we need to provide opportunity for education, choice, being able to, you know, really sit side by side with patients. Healthcare really has moved towards this shared decision making. But I think there's so many things we can do towards a health system that focuses on what are the kind of fundamentals of health and how do we build systems for that, but then also in allowing, at the end of the day, you were, you know, I'm so sorry to hear about your back, Lori, but, you know, running is a great mental and physical healthy way to stay active, but that's an individual choice that you're making every single day to make yourself healthy and well, and we all make those choices. So what ways can we make sure we empower those as well? So could go into health policy for a long time, but at the end of the day, I do think we need to acknowledge that individual priorities may be different than societal priorities, and how do we balance those with open, honest discussion, and how do we set that scorecard to what makes us healthy and well at the end of the day.
Your thoughts, Dr. Butler?
Yeah, I think Dr. Zink has really hit on something here. It's a little different answer to your question maybe than you thought about, because the question really focused on health care. And I think both Dr. Zink and I would want to emphasize the role of health and staying healthy, which is much broader than just access to treatment. A lot of what we think about as being healthy really is treatment of disease. And I think we need to go upstream and talk about how to stay healthy to begin with. And that's a very broad portfolio. In the intro, you mentioned immunizations. That's an important tool in the box. But there's many other things as well, including physical activity, maintaining a good body weight, using alcohol in moderation, if at all, getting enough rest, and then control of the environment. And that's where we start getting into maybe some of the more controversial issues around public health, ways that we make our communities healthy, and as I like to say, make the healthy choice the easy choice.
Such as controversy over fluoride in drinking water and things like that?
Well, that's a good example because on one hand, putting fluoride in the water makes the healthy choice the easy choice. The question, the controversy comes up as to whether or not the risks and benefits really balance out very well. Mm-hmm. I think the bulk of the evidence points towards fluoride being beneficial. The very low increased rates of certain types of bone cancer that have been associated with drinking fluoridated water is astronomically low. On the other hand, you know, I think having a discussion about whether or not there's other sources of fluoride that are available now that weren't available in the 1950s is a reasonable discussion to have.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Zink, you mentioned in an earlier interview that much of the health monitoring that the CDC does is not available right now because of the shutdown. RSV, a respiratory illness, is spreading in Florida, but there's no tracking currently. How damaging is this lack of continuity for healthcare monitoring and tracking, and what does it affect, and is that information lost, or will it be updated and caught up when the government reopens?
It's a great question. I think there's a lot of challenges and changes happening right now in data modernization and infrastructure. Part of that has to do with the president's priorities and the secretary's priorities. Part of it has to do with the government shutdown. But honestly, part of it also has to do with the way that there's been a lot of consolidation within healthcare. Electronic medical records have really changed the ways that we interact with healthcare. And then also just the way that technology is rapidly changing our everyday lives. The way that I interact with my phone or the fact I'm here with you remotely is changing things rapidly. So currently with the shutdown, we can't see national syndromic surveillance coming from the CDC. I really felt as though, as a practicing emergency physician, as well as a public health leader, I couldn't make good decisions without having good data. And so part of what I've been doing since I stepped down from the state is trying to have better data out there. So launched a project with Yale called PopHive, and anyone's welcome to go to it. And we were able to work with electronic medical records to share de-identified data. So currently, today, it's the only place in the nation where you can see the RSV rates uptaking, particularly in the Southeast. And so we've got opportunities to be able to share that data and information. I think it poses a really interesting question that we're, I think, all grappling with. Most of the public health authorities lie within local jurisdictions or state, but not really within the federal government. And there's been this relationship with states and the federal government to share data. But oftentimes, there's no reason they have to share data. They don't share data for certain reasons. And there's a lot of kind of back and forth in that space. And about 80% of our public health data comes from the healthcare sector. And so what ways can academics, what ways can private sector also stand in? You know, I oftentimes joke that no one asks the Department of Transportation to make Google Maps. And so I don't think we need to rely on the government to do all of these things. And so it's been actually really fun to work in the academic setting and in the private sector to be able to get these tools available. I think the tools are needed. We need to see what's happening. I do think that there's a real role that government plays and don't want to dismiss that or undermine that. I also think that it's been a very abrupt change. So people are very used to going to CDC for a lot of this data. And with it suddenly being down is causing a lot of havoc in the meantime. But I think it's an opportunity for us to envision and vision what we want for a healthy community and a healthy society. And what ways do we want government to play in that versus what ways we want the healthcare sector, individuals, data to be able to all play. And I think there's a lot of really healthy, robust conversation happening right now.
All right. If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska. And today we're talking about the future of public health and public health policy. Our guests are Dr. Jay Butler, the former CDC Deputy Director of Infectious Disease and the new Dean of the College of Health at University of Alaska Anchorage. Also on the line with us is Dr. Ann Zink, who is the former Chief Medical Officer for Alaska and is an emergency room physician in Palmer. Dr. Butler, you earlier noted concerns over the loss of leadership at CDC that came after your resignation. Talk about your concerns related to people, policy, progress, and politicization of the CDC. All those P's.
All the P's. So I think when it comes to people, I mean, I've just in the past week, my own experience, I've heard from a state epidemiologist who I was talking with who said they don't know who to contact anymore at CDC, that the contacts that they had, the subject matter experts that they had, their personal cells, they're not there anymore. And on top of that, we have the government shutdown. So the staff that remains at CDC are mostly people who are involved in emergency responses. That's very different than the last shutdown that occurred in 2018-2019. The entire agency of CDC was considered priority and exempt from the shutdown. I actually traveled to Atlanta and did my visit to begin the planning for the position of Deputy Director for Infectious Diseases during that shutdown.
Interesting.
So it's very, very different this time around. I've talked with a provider in the past week that called me. This was an infectious disease colleague taking care of a brucellosis case. Mm-hmm. Side note about challenges with drinking raw milk in another state. And he didn't know who he could contact. He needed some clinical consultation. That's the kind of service that CDC has provided in the past and fortunately was able to arrange some discussions. But I think the loss of leadership has been a challenge. And there's people who remain who are dedicated public servants. I think when we look at just what happened after the shooting that occurred at CDC in August, we saw hundreds of people come out and stand publicly to be in support of other leadership that were being fired and being actually escorted off the campus on that day. And I, just as a side note, I think it's a challenging time for morale when the Secretary of HHS describes the agency as a cesspool of corruption. The shooting was never acknowledged by anywhere in the federal government other than quietly FBI has continued the investigation. So it's very, very hard. And I know that there are CDC employees right now who are driving Uber and doing DoorDash to be able to make ends meet, like many of our other federal colleagues. I think when we talk about policy, you know, every state, I'm going to use just as an example, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. Most states reference ACIP as the gold standard for vaccine policy. You know, it's part of the bigger picture of where the federal government comes into play around vaccines. I mean, a manufacturer can't just roll out a vaccine and put it on the market. I mean, we have a very good evaluation system for efficacy and safety in this country. And many countries look to the U.S. as the example, or at least they have in the past. FDA reviews the data on efficacy and safety and decides whether or not a vaccine should be licensed. And then the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices at the CDC goes through then how should we use it. And they also vote on some of the issues around coverage for administering the vaccine. For example, when the COVID vaccines first became available, oftentimes the FDA meetings were on Friday, which was great for us at CDC, because then we would meet on Saturday with the ACIP, review the data, and usually by Saturday night had a recommendation of how the vaccine should be rolled out and moved forward. Many states reference in their policies the ACIP is the gold standard. So right now, there are many states going back and rewriting those regulations to cite professional societies and groups other than ACIP, because sadly right now, ACIP is not a trusted source of scientific information anymore.
And that is because people were replaced, career scientists were replaced with political appointees. Is that accurate?
Yeah, the ACIP is actually made up of external experts. So oftentimes these are people from an academic background who've done research in the development of vaccines or in immunology, and then they're supported by the career scientists at CDC. Many of those career scientists are either now gone or right now they're actually furloughed. Plus, ACIP, the entire crew was fired in June, and then a new crew was brought in. The stated reason was that there was corruption, conflict of interest, yet the vetting for the new members seemed very, very nebulous. I have no idea what was done. I mean, the way words like transparency are thrown around right now seem almost Orwellian in terms of how I don't understand how these words are being applied.
And when allegations of corruption are leveled, is there any evidence coming forward with those allegations? That's a pretty serious charge to say there's corruption there.
It's a very serious charge. And seems like just the labels are applied, but no justification is used to that. I know there was a review of ACIP some 25 years ago that really, I think, called for tightening up the review process. And the number of conflicts of interest has really declined pretty dramatically over the past 25 years at ACIP. But I mean, I think the fact is, if you want an expert in vaccine science or immunology, you're oftentimes going to be going to academia and finding a scientist who's had research funded oftentimes by the pharmaceutical industry. So if taking all of those people out of the mix, you've got a much smaller pool of people to choose from who are left.
For both of you, in thinking back during the COVID pandemic and lessons learned coming out of that, one of the things that I found out post the biggest ravages of the pandemic, when people were very suspicious of the vaccine, saying, hey, wait a minute, it took 5 years to develop the polio vaccine. How did they do this in months? I'm suspicious of this. And post the most serious waves of the pandemic, I read a lot about how new technology and artificial intelligence really helped speed up the research side of that process and made it a much more faster and more efficient process to get to approval because of advances in technology. The light bulb kind of went off for me, and I thought, well, that makes perfect sense, but why didn't we know more about that earlier so that people maybe could have had more faith? When you look back at what was going on at that time, what's been learned about how to better message information to folks so that they can be more trusting in the future?
Well, I think COVID vaccines became available so quickly thanks to three things. First of all was the mRNA vaccine technology. And that was not brand new. It was actually grew out of some of the work around the SARS outbreak almost 25 years ago now. So there had already been a baseline level of research and even some immunology and safety data on using mRNA vaccines against a coronavirus in the past. So that gave us a leg up. Second thing was there was so much COVID circulating at the time that the trials could be conducted fairly quickly. And it was really beyond my wildest dreams. Those initial studies that showed 90% efficacy, it's lower now because oftentimes there are less susceptible people in the community as we assess the impact of vaccines. But at the time, it was just almost miraculous in terms of how high. I think my wildest dreams at the time is that it might be as good as, say, the seasonal flu vaccine, which generally runs 50, 60% in a good year. And then the third thing was the Trump administration made the decision to make a big investment in mRNA vaccines. So it took away that financial risk for the industries that produce vaccines in our countries. And, you know, we can have a whole discussion about whether or not the way capitalism works is the best way to make vaccines or not. But the reality is that is how we function in this society, and it took away that risk. I've never worked for a pharmaceutical company, but I can see their perspective in terms of vaccines are usually not big money makers. You want a pill that you have to take every day for the rest of your life, or something that prevents obesity or addresses erectile dysfunction. These are the big money makers for the industry.
Dr. Zink, your thoughts about some lessons that were learned and about messaging so that when we face the next public health emergency, that people will have more faith and confidence in what they're being told.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And I think there's been great feedback from Alaskans on this radio show, on social media, and all sorts of other places on what ways to communicate better. I don't think you can ever communicate enough. And I always reminded that communication is twice as much listening as it is talking. And so I think really hearing people's concerns and fears is a really important part of communication. People are smart and educated and want to do the best for their family. And, you know, I see patients all the time in the emergency department who are very concerned on medical treatment because they're worried they're going to go bankrupt. They don't understand the reasoning for it, or they're, you know, fearful of the consequences. And they're trying to make the absolute best decision that they can for themselves and their loved ones that moment. I'll never forget, you know, taking my kiddo in to get her first vaccines. And she's got this, you know, tiny little cute little thigh, and it's scary. And it's, you know, you have to kind of think about the disease and the risk factors and the rest of it. I really hope that we're able to move more towards what, you know, I call shared decision making. Again, in healthcare, I see myself as walking side by side with my patient to say, this is what we know about a CT scan or about an MRI or about this treatment for pneumonia based on what I'm seeing. Does this meet your values and what you need? Does this meet what you want done? And I get patients all the time who say, no, I don't want to be treated for my cancer, or I don't want surgery. I want a second opinion, or I want to wait. And I think that's very valid. And the more that they come in with tools and resources and are educated, the more we can have a really in-depth conversation. I always encourage people to have that. But it's much harder when you're talking at a population level. You know, if I'm on a newscast or a press release or a press conference with a governor, you don't have the opportunity to hear from people in that same sort of way. And so that's why we, you know, had echoes on a very regular basis to hear from people, but then also to share the information that we were getting. So, like, I really loved the CDC's campaign about mild to wild, how vaccines help to take something that, particularly respiratory vaccines, that have real risk for a severe consequence and try to make it less severe. That doesn't mean it's going to stop everything. You know, even the comment of safe and effective, there, you know, people have sometimes adverse reactions, and that's not to be dismissed or taken lightly. And so creating ways that we can learn from the science, we can be able to respond, but then as clinicians and as public health leaders, we're able to share that information and listen loudly to the communities of what they want. So again, to me, that's a lot of the ways that we share data, the ways that we share information, the way that we get that to healthcare providers. You know, as an ER physician, I usually am like, are you up to date on your immunizations? Is your tetanus up to date? I'm not an infectious disease doc like Dr. Butler. And I relied on the pediatricians to have those more nuanced conversations. But I think, you know, all clinicians are learning to have more nuanced conversations because that's what people want and expect. I also think sometimes we talk so much about the messaging, which is important, and not enough about the systems. You know, I've shared actually here on Alaska Public Media that I didn't get my flu shot last year simply because the place I normally get it wasn't offering it, and I never got it scheduled to go do it a separate time. So sometimes these just barriers, and back to what Dr. Butler said about making the right choice or the healthy choice an easy choice, we don't spend enough time thinking about how to make those choices easy and how do we make it simple. And I think that's a lot of what we should be doing in public health, is how to make choices simple and easy, but allowing people to make the choices themselves in as many ways as possible. So These are a lot of lessons learned, and we'll continue to learn them. And part of the reason why I agreed to host Line One is I always love hearing from people. I love hearing from people on social media about what they're concerned about in the communication, because, again, it's more listening than it is talking.
Well, we are going to take a quick break, but I do want to read one email question here for Dr. Zink before we go to break. Jason writes, Dr. Zink, you are so smart and knowledgeable and balanced and normal. Would you please consider running for governor next year? And on that note, we are going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in just a moment with our continued discussion on the future of public health policy with Dr. Jay Butler and Dr. Ann Zink as Talk of Alaska continues statewide. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing the future of public health and public health policy with our guests, Dr. Jay Butler, formerly with the CDC as the Deputy Director of Infectious Disease, and now the new Dean of the College of Health at UAA starting in December. On the line with us is Dr. Ann Zink, who is a former Chief Medical Officer for Alaska and is an emergency room physician in Palmer. And both Dr. Butler and Dr. Zink are hosts of Line One, Your Health Connection. Dr. Zink, you were talking a little bit about this earlier, the shared decision-making. And talk a bit more about that, the difference in older and younger patients. I was thinking about when I was a young mother and when the difference, and I'm old now, and so the difference in how doctors discuss things with you then as opposed to now, when I would ask questions about what should I know about the vaccines my baby's getting, or will there be side effects, will they get a fever? And one doctor I remember being very dismissive of my questions, and it was not a comfortable situation because I wanted information to know what I should prepare for, and he just felt I don't know what he felt. But you noted that there is a difference in your older and younger patients and their expectations. I know my sister, who was in the healthcare field for her career, always said, write stuff down, take a list of your questions so that you can ask and make sure you've got all your questions with you and write down the answers. Otherwise, you'll forget when you get there. What do you see in distinctions between your younger and older folks?
Yeah, I appreciate you sharing your story as well, because I think that dismissal is common and is very frustrating for patients. When I hear people and their frustration with public health, it's oftentimes a conversation like that where they're frustrated with something about the healthcare system or an interaction with the healthcare system that public health actually doesn't have any control over, but it leads to this kind of increasing mistrust and feeling of being dismissed. And I think it's so important that we never dismiss someone's experience or questions in that space. But like you mentioned, I do see really generational differences. You know, my older patients oftentimes are like, doc, just tell me what I'm supposed to do. How many meds am I supposed to take? And I'm like, okay, that's what they want. I was joking with someone the other day and I said, you know, there is an older generation that would say, you know, I can do it. I feel like my generation is like I can, but do I have to? I feel like the generation below me is like, well, you know, show me like why that's important. And then I feel like my children's generation is like, prove it, like prove to me that I really need to do this or not. And I think that that is because, you know, my kids grew up with technology all the time. They grew up with a world. I was telling them about Encyclopedia Britannicas that we had in our house growing up, and they were like so confused that that was my entire access to like knowledge. They were like,
physical books?
No, physical books, like you couldn't just Google that. And I was like, no, I couldn't Google any of those things, let alone ask ChatGPT to give me a whole plan on how to deal with it. And so I think we have to be mindful of the way that the world changes and the ways that we communicate and the information and knowledge that's there. And I find myself oftentimes dialing my shared decision-making information to what the patient desires. And if they say, just tell me what to do, I'm like, okay, this is what I would do in that situation. If they're like, I have 15, you know, questions, then I'm like, okay, let's talk about those questions. I joke in the emergency department that I'm not there just to figure out what might hurt someone, what kill someone, but I'm also there to figure out what's most likely, but sometimes most importantly, what they're most afraid of. And I think really trying to understand what people's fears are or concerns is as important of a process that we need to do both in healthcare as well as public health to understand those concerns and those fears to be able to take the next step forward to making healthy decisions.
Dr. Butler, your thoughts?
Yeah, I really agree with Governor Zink. Did I say governor? I meant Dr. Zink.
You heard it here first, folks.
There's generational differences, and I think we see that in some of our elected officials. The way Mitch McConnell has voted in the Senate, I think, has been determined in part by his own experience of having polio as a child. The older generation remembers the bad old days. Younger generation, and particularly parents of young children, what I find is most important to remember is they love their children. So vaccine-hesitant parents are not being abusive. They are looking for the best things that they can do to take care of their kids. And it's a challenge sometimes when some of the information that's coming at all of us is very confusing. But I think that's where it gets back to what Dr. Zink was saying, that you have to sit side by side with the patients and understand that they are just trying to do what's best for their kids or even for themselves and taking care of their health.
Well, and as we know, trust is so paramount. Your jobs are similar to my job as a journalist. Trust is paramount with the public, and it's the same thing with doctors. People have to trust what you're saying and that the way that you're answering their questions is something they can believe in. Let's go to the phones for a moment. Carol is in Douglas. Hello, Carol.
Hello.
Did you have a question?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
I do. I work with people with autism, and I want to know what you guys think about, I don't know if you want to call it pseudoscience or whatever's going on. For instance, that Tylenol causes autism, because it just defies logic, because autism was discovered as a condition way, way decades, maybe 100 years before Tylenol was invented. And number two, if you look at whenever I talk to a parent, you know, whose child has autism, and they're often wondering, you know, is it my fault, whatever, I say, look to the Octomom. I don't know if you remember her, but she had 8 children all at the same time, and 7 of them that were neurotypical. One was very autistic. And it wasn't because she had Tylenol, and that Tylenol went toward the one kid. I mean, it just defies logic, some of these things that are said, and I think they're very harmful. What do you think?
All right. Thanks for the call, Carol. Autism and Tylenol, big controversy there. Dr. Butler.
It seemed like it was a bit of a pivot away from vaccines to suddenly focus on acetaminophen or Tylenol. The justifications that were given didn't cut it very well for me. I know there was talk of there not being autism in Cuba and there not being Tylenol there.
Or is it just not?
Well, it is diagnosed. That's where it's increasingly, I think, a struggle as a public health official to understand even what's being said sometimes, because that's not what the evidence indicates. It's not what the data says. Also, in the Caribbean and actually most of the world, what we call acetaminophen or brand name Tylenol is called paracetamol. So they do use it there. You know, it's not like I can go to studies and say, well, let's look at this data together and find what's truth, because we're starting out with something that doesn't even make sense to me. And that's where, you know, I don't want to just throw up my hands. I want to have conversations to understand, why do you think that? Mm-hmm. I oftentimes say it kind of goes back to the theological concept of epistemology. How do you know what you know, and what makes you say that? And I'm hoping that somehow those conversations could help move us towards a better understanding of what's truth and what's the best health policy.
Dr. Zink, your thoughts on the Tylenol and autism debate?
Yeah, no, I really appreciate the question. You know, a couple things I first want to say. You know, to the caller, thank you for your service to patients with autism. It can be an incredibly challenging diagnosis with a huge spectrum. And there has been cries for a long time to have more understanding, more studies, more services and resources. And so I think that there is a lot of excitement there. There's more conversation now. But to Dr. Butler's point, we need to make sure that that conversation is grounded in science and in evidence, because at the end of the day, if we spend our energy chasing something where there's no real data or lead, we're missing the opportunity to create real solutions and real understanding of the causes of autism and how we can find a path forward, which is where I'm really hoping that we'll go. It reminds me a lot of how we all use conversation and communication and research slightly differently. So if I'm a scientist, I'm always speaking about the limitations of what I know. I joke about the limitations of limitations. But as a healthcare provider, I'm choosing to discuss with my patient how many of those limitations they want to know or not, and trying to make sure I'm meeting their needs. Sitting here with you all and discussing with the media, and we tend to really just try to get the point across and happy to go into deeper things, but trying to tell a story, trying to communicate to a large audience. But if I'm a lawyer, I'm picking and choosing information to defend my point. And our current Secretary of Health, you know, is a lawyer, and his entire career has been choosing evidence to prove a point, which I think is just a really different way at looking at communication and looking at evidence than a scientist who says, prove me wrong. I need to make sure that this is 100% right. And there's a continuum, and each has its own skill set. But I don't want to get caught in the lawyer communication of proving a point and miss the really important scientific rigor that patients with autism deserve to really understand the root causes and try to find solutions, because it can be very, very, very challenging and also very enlightening. I mean, I see so many kiddos and adults with autism on a regular basis, and it can provide such joy. But I think we should really, we owe it to them to be honest about the science and data. I would also just point people to a Line One that I did last month with a pediatrician, where we talked quite a bit at length about how he talks to his patients about Tylenol making this decision. Because I think way too often we blame parents. Parents already come with so much guilt about all the things that we do. And I hate seeing an extra burden of guilt on parents when we don't have any evidence that there's anything that they did that has caused their child's autism.
You had said in a past interview, Dr. Zink, that you're excited about how technology enables people to be more informed about their decisions and for personal medicine. And certainly there is a wealth of information online. It can be the great equalizer as far as people having access to wonderful educational materials, but it can also be the great destroyer and confuser because of disinformation that's online. How much does that challenge what you're both doing now in healthcare, having patients, folks come in and say, no, I know that this is what I need, or the direct marketing of drugs to consumers that started happening, I don't know, so many decades ago. How does that complicate those discussions when suddenly somebody is a backseat medical professional?
Well, I always say that patients should be the front seat medical professional. No one knows or cares as much about the health as they do. You know, I always tell patients, particularly moms or dads in the emergency department, you know your kid in a way I will never know your kid. I'm just here in this short bit of time to support you to be the best parent you can. And that might be dealing with a fever at 2 a.m. or, you know, a fall and trying to figure out what we need to do for the next steps. I do agree with you with the way that information has changed. Sometimes it feels like the Tower of Babylon, where we're all kind of having slightly different conversations rather than really listening loudly to each other and trying to understand and to sit across different areas of communication. I think this is, you know, I joked during the pandemic at one point, people said, what do you wish you had? And I said, I wish that the public had a better understanding of denominators. I think that there's a real need for scientific education, for empowering individuals to get a good sense of what's a good study, what's not a good study, what do I need to know in this space. And that's a lot of time, and that can be a lot of effort. And that's where I do think it comes down to finding a healthcare provider that you can trust, that you feel like won't dismiss you for your questions. You know, I don't want to actually know how to fix my car that well, and I really trust my mechanic, and they're great. When I have problems, I bring it in. But I can ask questions and not be dismissed. And so I think that there is this expertise. You know, we trained for a long time in medical school and in public health to be able to understand the scientific process, to share questions, to look critically. I'm working working on a publication right now in the New England Journal of Medicine. And, you know, the peer review process is long. There's a lot of back and forth of people going back and forth and saying, is this really 100% true? What else do we know about this? And so I think thinking about trusted sources, peer reviewed processes, trusted messengers that you know that you can bring questions to, but that doesn't dismiss the need to be able to ask questions. And I think sometimes we conflate the two. So I want to really encourage people to ask questions, but then go to places that have had transparent information. You know, who are they funded by? What does that look like? And I'm with you. I wish we actually never had pharmaceuticals directly market to the public because there's a lot of misinformation that can happen in that space as well.
And that could be one of the good things that may happen under Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s leadership, is getting rid of direct marketing of drugs to consumers. We need to take another quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion with our two medical professionals, Dr. Jay Butler and Dr. Ann Zink, as Talk of Alaska continues statewide. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Dr. Jay Butler, who is the new dean of the College of Health at UAA and a former CDC Deputy Director of Infectious Disease, and Dr. Ann Zink, a former Chief Medical Officer for Alaska and an emergency room physician in Palmer. Both doctors are also hosts of Line One, Your Health Connection. Let's go back to the phones for a moment. Ed is in Bethel. Hello, Ed.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for the opportunity to ask. I'm here because although I'm a retired nurse, my wife is still working and her concentration is in tuberculosis, which is virtually unspoken in the lower 48. Given where we are with the current administration and its focuses or absence of them, I'm just wondering, what's the plan in Alaska to address the high TB rates in comparison to the rest of the modern world?
All right. The new dean of the College of Health maybe has some thoughts about that.
Well, let me start by saying, Ed, I really share your concern about tuberculosis. It is an old scourge in Alaska. I really encourage people to read Robert Fortine's book, Must We All Die?, about the history of tuberculosis in Alaska. And tuberculosis had a particular impact as a disease of colonization among Alaska Native people, with very high rates of death and disease. If we look at, for instance, Alaska Native Medical Center, the beautiful facility that's just a mile or so from where we sit in the studio today, it's only one-third of the size of the original ANS that was built down on 3rd Avenue. And why did they need all those beds in the 1950s? It was because there were so many patients with tuberculosis. Tuberculosis is one of those easy-to-forget diseases. It's an infectious disease that's caused by the bacterium, Mycobacterium tuberculosis. Oftentimes, people are infected and are not aware of it until the disease flares up, and then it can be spread person to person during those disease flares. It has done this before, and we've done this before. We've ignored tuberculosis. In the late 1980s, funding for tuberculosis control went way down, and what we saw was a resurgence of tuberculosis. When I was doing my infectious disease training at Emory University in the 1990s, it was amazing the things that we had to do at Grady Hospital to be able to manage patients with tuberculosis. Sometimes putting the TB patients in hallways with giant fans to try and control the airflow because we had more patients than there were beds. Now, fortunately, because of the funding and the support for state, local, tribal agencies to address tuberculosis more aggressively, and also to be able to recognize the syndemic, the combined epidemics of TB and HIV, and addressing both of those at once, rates came down again. I worry that it could all happen again. because of the challenges that we're seeing in public health right now and the lack of support for tuberculosis infrastructure. So I believe that the state may indeed have a strategy for TB control, and basically the approach is to test for people who are infected with TB regardless of symptoms, and to be able to treat those individuals to be able to eradicate the organism before it becomes a disease-causing germ and before it could potentially be spread to others. The other, as we had signs around the hospital all the time and still do today, is Think TB. If you have a patient that's being kind of difficult to diagnose with any of a range of symptoms, not just pulmonary or respiratory symptoms, think about TB, because that's what could be causing it. And being able to recognize that and treat it and also be able to isolate that patient until they're no longer infectious is the foundation to TB control.
All right. Well, thank you, Ed, for that question and that concern. Let's stay with the phones for a moment in our final couple minutes here. Anne is in Anchorage. Hello, Anne.
Hi. Thanks for taking my question. In October 2025, governors formed the Governors Public Health Alliance, a multi-state group that was working to strengthen public health collaboration and preparedness, sharing data and expertise across states, particularly in vaccine policy and response to health threats like we've been talking about this morning. I was really excited to see that Dr. Zink is one of the bipartisan public health advisors for this group. So my question to Dr. Zink and Dr. Butler is if they would be willing to work with other medical and healthcare leaders in Alaska, like the chief medical officer for Anchorage, maybe the leads for ANTHC, Alaska Native Medical Center, Providence Regional Hospitals, Planned Parenthood, and others, they know all these folks, and urge Governor Dunleavy to join this group. I know it might be outside what he usually does, but I think it would be really good to let more people in our, just by starting a campaign, maybe writing an op-ed about this, letting people in Alaska know more about this group. And we've got our great Dr. Zink on it, and it would be fabulous if Alaska could become part of this to help everybody in the state get better medical information.
All right. Well, thanks, Anne, for that. Dr. Zink.
Yeah, no, thanks for the comment. One thing I wanted to just circle back with Ed's comment previously is that there is state funding that the legislature approved a couple years ago to increase the treatment for TB, and been really grateful for the state's commitment to that, but really hopeful that we can do more. And I think that gets into Anne's question a little bit about what states can do. The reason I said yes to being an advisor on that is really the authority for health. It really lies within the governor. And so many times I remember being at a Rotary call and people being very frustrated that I didn't oversee insurance because I was at the Department of Health that doesn't have that in their bailiwick at all. And so there's many different departments that impact health. And so the hope of that governor's alliance is to be able to educate and support governors to be able to support their patients on both emerging diseases, everything from vaccination, but also healthcare costs and what ways government can do better to be able to serve patients better. So really working with that group to try to make sure no matter if a governor signs on or doesn't sign on, that those resources and tools are there, but really hopeful that we will get more governors to kind of lean into health. It's oftentimes a huge part of the budget. It's the number one reason for bankruptcy. It has a big impact on people's health, and having governors educated and aware of what's happening in the health sector is fundamental to everything from budget to economy. I always say healthy economies are built with healthy people. So excited to continue to support all states and the governor's role in that space.
So we only have a minute left here, and I wanted to get to a question to get your thoughts quickly about the effects of climate change on health and what may be coming in the future for increases in bacterial infections or emerging viruses. I was reading the other day about the amount of precipitation, the atmospheric rivers concern that is happening in our world and how much more moisture is in the atmosphere and how that will affect things going forward. Dr. Butler, in about 30 seconds or so, what do you think might be our next concerns on the horizon?
Well, I think one of the things for us in the far north is not only the melting permafrost, but also the northward migration of a number of disease vectors, particularly arthropod vectors, mosquitoes, ticks, things like that. The other thing I'll mention is I think there's a lot of cutting-edge science in what we call aerobiology, that is the ability of certain microbes to travel through the air, and how wildfires can contribute to that, that certain fungi can actually attach to the particulates generated during a wildfire and survive the heat and actually be potentially infectious to animals or to humans.
Interesting. Dr. Zink, in a few seconds, your thoughts?
It's going to affect us all in so many different ways, not only in the movement of diseases, the movement of vectors, as Dr. Butler was just mentioning, but also in disaster and emergency response. So grateful for so many who responded to this most recent typhoon. But I think that these are going to be increasing challenges, and public health plays a huge role in helping to support and mitigate the impact of such large climate changes. Thanks.
All right. Well, I just want to say on behalf of all of us here, thank you both so much for the work that you do to help all Alaskans have healthier lives. Thank you for your dedication and the importance of the expertise that you bring to us all. Thanks to our guests, Dr. Jay Butler and Dr. Ann Zink. Thanks to our engineer, Chris Hyde. Our producer is Madeline Rose. Our editor is Annie Feit. On the phones, Ava White helped us out today. And I'm Lori Townsend. Thanks for listening and for your questions. We'll be back next week.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.